Welcome, everybody, to Space Force. I'm Jason Tondra, one of your hosts.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Aid. Hello.
And it has been a hell of a week. Here we are, 4 days after a violent and lethal mob took over the Senate floor of the United States Capitol, called for the vice president to be executed, built a gallows out front of the building, killed a Capitol police officer, and came within seconds of getting into the Senate floor chamber when the members were still there. And now we're here to talk about Star Trek. It's just, it's a strange era that we live in. I hope all of you are okay. And maybe we can find some optimism and hope in a show dedicated to that premise. I don't know. How is everybody? Jim, how are you guys doing before we talk about the show?
Well, I'm just like I mentioned before the show, I do a mental health regimen with various apps from the Apple Store. Particularly fond of Bloom, which is CBT therapy, which, you know, is structured to journal. Like you're giving written prompts, and it's a good way to just, you know, put it out there and have it, you know, and you're typing on your phone, which, you know, I'm sort of used to now that Twitter has brainwashed me.
Sure.
So, you know, when I try to journal with a book, it's always felt like a hindrance. Like, what if I don't put the right word down? But when I type it on my phone, because I have the delete button, I don't have to worry about that. So that anxiety is like immediately nixed.
Yeah, good.
So I've been doing that and, you know, trying to help, you know, people on my Twitter feed who are struggling worse than I am, you know, with a word of encouragement, hail, you know, good work there kind of thing. And that's as much as I can do.
That's pretty good to reach out to other people. I think that's a great way for us to get through all of this together. Aid, how about you're in the UK? What did you think about what you saw?
Yeah, we're having our second week of our lockdown over here, so everyone's getting a bit antsy. Possibly up to March, they reckon it's going to be. And we've got the Brexit stuff going on, so there's a lot of stuff happening really at the moment for the first month of the year. It's like, can we fit anywhere else in? Yeah, mate, all we need now is a giant meteorite to come plummeting towards the Earth, and that's like, yeah, tick that off the list as well. That'd be fine. So, it's a strange one. Definitely a strange one.
We all wanted 2020 to be over, but this is like the post-credit scene for 2020, right?
Exactly.
Like, it's still going on.
This is where Michael Myers crawls out of the grave at the end and goes, I'm still here. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. All right. Well, so the second half of our season finale cliffhanger involves the retake over of the ship, Burnham and the bridge crew, you know, on different missions. The bridge crew end up, like, we finally find out why Discovery got redesigned, so that we can basically separate one of the nacelles from the hull of the ship and thereby bring it out of warp. I think that was the plan, if I understand what was happening. Which it turns into a suicide mission in which we believe most or all of the crew is going to die. Meanwhile, Burnham and Book get captured, which leads to a final punch out with... In true Star Trek Discovery fashion, it ends in a kung fu fight between Burnham and Osira in the data core for the Discovery, which we have never seen before, I don't think. Have we? I don't know. Have you seen it before?
No. Brand new set.
Yeah. And then, meanwhile, on the dilithium planet, our crew slowly bring the traumatized Kelpian there, Sukal, face to face with the trauma of his mother's death and the realization that he himself is responsible for his own isolation. And it ends on a, you know, fairly happy note. Like, the only conflict that's left in the show, and we will talk about it because it bugged me, or I noticed it, is the tension between Burnham and Stamets. after Stamets' feelings of betrayal when Burnham kicked him off the ship last episode. But otherwise, it's a brand new Discovery era. Burnham is captain. They've all got new uniforms. The Federation is not evil. No time travel shenanigans that we have been expecting all season. And Discovery is off on a new mission to make new contact with all the various groups that have been isolated from the Federation from the Burn and bring them back into interstellar society.
And let's not forget the gelato.
The gelato. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Let's not forget the Starbase's famous gelato.
The Starbase's famous gelato. Yeah. It was a thing. What did you guys think of it? Jim, you get to go first this time.
I'm in much the same camp. It happened. I'm not dismayed that any of my predictions proved hollow. Again, those were more to contextualize it within what I was trying to say is I don't want these things to happen, but I feel that this is where we're heading.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we initially postulated early on when we were talking about like time travel being used to reboot the universe.
Yeah.
You said that like Saru was going to be in favor of it and then Bonin would be the one against it. Hmm. And at that point, like I think we were episode two in, and I was like, I can't quite see like in terms of how those characters were being positioned. If we do have a revisit of time travel in season four, I can now see Saru as the one advocating for Sukal because we don't know what his mental state's going to be going into season four. Like, how do you come back from that?
I think we can kind of put time travel to rest for a while, don't you?
I'm hoping so.
Hoping so.
But I kind of feel like it's sort of the Chekhov's gun of Star Trek.
Yeah, it is.
It was time travel that brought us to this context. And I'm hoping we can move past it and not have to worry about it. But I'm sort of worried that if time travel brings us to a context, can we use time travel to reboot it? It's still like I'm still nervous because we're not getting regular, average, everyday adventures set in this time period. We get mystery seasons. Right. So the mystery was, what was the Bourne? Now we know what the Bourne is. Are we going to revisit that? Or are we going? Is season four going to be moving forward? And I hope season four is moving forward.
Hey, what'd you think about the episode?
Yeah, not great. Not happy with it that much. I just think that this is a Discovery not just dipping their toe into the Kelvinverse way of doing things. It's literally cannonballing their way into their swimming pool. it's like, what can we do? We need more action. We need more explosions. We need more death. We need this. This is just weird. It's just, and again, virtually every single solution to all of the stuff that's been set up is largely unsatisfactory, in my opinion, to me. I said before in the notes, I get the impression that a lot of this episode was set up as like the first thing we can do. Right, this is where we want to be. This is where we want to reach to. And then they backtracked all of the stuff so that they could get to this point and go, ha ha, look, it was all thought of from day one. And you go, yeah, that's because you've kind of strung your way through it and weird stuff happened on just to get you to this point in time.
Yeah.
But it tied up some loose ends. I think if you go by what's happening, if season four happens the way it looks like, it could just be, at the moment, a Star Trek show set in the future.
Yeah.
That's kind of what we're looking at. But as we've seen before, if they don't have a mystery to hang it on, which it seems to be the general solution to all of the shows at the moment, then we're going to be just having another what's the big problem to solve this time around, and we'll faff around for 12 episodes, and then on the 13th episode it'll be solved, and that'd be it. So yeah,
it very much struck me at the end as setting. You know, Jim, you've often described Disco as Voyager done, an attempt to do Voyager done right, right? But it felt like an original series setup at the end of this season. Like we're going to, except curiously, it's almost like Lower Decks because their job is second contact. right? Like the Discovery's job now is to go out to all of these places that used to be part of the Federation and make contact and give them dilithium and bring them back in. And it's totally second contact. And then we can do a Planet of the Week every episode.
The Federation postman. It's like, hello, yeah. Delivery.
Yeah.
So weird.
But all right, so let's get to particular issues about the show. So first off, I have to do my bragging rights. I'm going to do it early and get them out of the way because I've decided that apparently I really suck at predicting what's going to happen in an episode. Like as I'm watching it, I have no idea what's going to happen, but apparently I'm 2 for 2 on guessing season finales. because we found the dilithium planet. They're going to use the dilithium planet to recreate the Federation. There's no time travel. Saru leaves the ship. Burnham becomes captain. The only thing that is missing is that Admiral, what's his name?
Vance.
Did not actually say, quote, that hope is you again, like I thought he would. But he gave that speech.
He might as well.
Yeah, he didn't say that line, but totally gave that speech. And honestly, I felt it was kind of lame. Like, I kind of hated to be proven right. Maybe this is why I don't like movies where I know the ending, because like, okay, so I know it's going to happen. But I nailed it. So cheers.
Going back to Aid's point in terms of like Discovery has a history of where is it that we want to end?
Yeah. Yeah.
And how can we backfill it to get to the ending that we want? So we want Burnham in the captain's chair. We want Let's Fly to be our last line. How do we move that and do it satisfactorily enough that it feels like a journey that was sort of predestined? And they did that with season one. Season one, they came out and they said, well, you know, after Brian Fuller left, we sat down and we were like, okay, here's the speech we want to give. We want Burnham to have the big Star Trek speech. How do we move all the pieces to that moment?
Yeah.
And then we'll give you the cliffhanger of Hail's the Enterprise.
Yeah.
Right. And we'll give you the classic music and we'll dub it into the credits and get you all excited and jazzed. Right.
Yeah.
The problem is the writers are denying themselves the discovery of the story.
Right.
So one of the things that I've just encountered through my own writing is that I can come up with an idea of what I want to have happen, but the story itself will eventually at some point tell me what it is. Yeah. And that may not even happen in the first draft form. That may happen in the second or the revision stage when I'm like, oh, this is a story about nurturing people. Like that's the thing that is the through line between my three action beats that I wasn't picking up because I'm not inclined to think in those terms. Yeah. But when I was revising and I had someone else look at it and they're like, oh, this is what you're doing. And I was like, you're blown away by that.
You recently just rewrote the entire ending on your current project.
Yeah. And to buttress what it was I was subliminally saying, but by constructing 13 episodes to get to an endpoint, none of the writers are allowing themselves the self-discovery of the writing process of, what is it my story actually is? And that's sort of the thing that we struggle with on the show. Like we've struggled with in this season is, okay, we're going to do a diehard pastiche. Well, what does that give us? What does that add to the conversation? What is that pushing forward? Like the last episode was so inconsequential that it was almost absent in the previously on Star Trek Discovery tagline.
Okay. So let's talk about that for a minute. Cause you guys both had some comments on this in the notes. Like, what do you mean by that when you say that the last episode was inconsequential?
It all it does is it removes Stamets from the crew. Stamets can be beamed away and you get the same plot. The basic construction of this episode does not rely on like because the Sukal episode is well the Emerald Chain takes over, right?
Yeah.
They take over the bridge, they have Discovery. We opened with this episode. If you missed it, if you did skip this week, last week, I don't think you're lost. All you need to know is that Stamets was blown out of the ship.
Yeah.
Like they don't even like Stamets shows up on the the Starfleet headquarters and gets escorted like assaultingly so outside of the bridge.
underway on a transport, apparently. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm confused by this because, like, okay, so apparently Book can operate the spore drive. Well, Book's powers are not unique to Book.
Yes.
So there's at least one other person on his home planet which can operate the spore drive. And presumably more? Like, can they train other people to do it? Can they, is it a biological thing? We don't know a lot about that yet. But what were some of your thoughts on this idea that that last episode was sort of irrelevant in the overall
The weird thing is, as I said before last time, the idea we had, Stamets basically saying, I need to get away. And, yeah. And go back to the nebula, like I said last time. The idea they could hide the discovery in the nebula inside the clouds so that it couldn't be attacked by the Osiris ship because you'd have to fly through the crowd. That's a perfect idea. And you could save Saru at the same time, right? Yeah, they could have done that. She pops him off. And as I said before, the idea, I couldn't figure out how they were going to get to where they needed to go because if you, as soon as you send Stamets off,
yeah,
you can't use a spore drive. And then they go, oh, Stamets, you can't stay here. The Discovery is too important to Starfleet to because they can go anywhere. Oh, by the way, we're now going to shoot at Discovery for the next 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And if it blows up, then we'll just, oh, well, there you go. I think, well, what is it? Is it important or not important? It's like, is it willable to be sacrificed or is keeping the actual ship up and running important or not?
There were things that bugged me. Yeah. I'm sorry, Ada, I interrupted you.
People. Yeah, that's all right. Yeah. But like you say, the idea... It's a network that's out there in space. Okay, Discovery is unique in the fact that it's the only actual ship that exists like this. But the technology is still 1,000 years old. So the idea now you can reconstruct the spore drive, stick on any ship, and get any planet, any guy from the planet on Book's planet to come and pilot all the ships around. Well, I can't see what's the problem with that at all. There's nothing. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing like fundamentally. Part of the problem, but again, it's like Book again. Book's character was created purely to like, oh, we need another guy to do the spore drive. Okay, well, I've got a great idea for a character. It's like there's no, it's always like you say, it's almost like this massive jigsaw puzzle, and all of the pieces fit exactly. There's nothing in there that's like, oh, well, that story didn't really make much difference, but it was important to that character at the time. It's like, oh yeah, we've got to have the stuff with Gray because that's got to show up. We've got to have the stuff with Book. He's got to be an empath because we need an empath in the last episode. Okay, we'll do that one. It's just, it's crazy. It's annoying.
But like, for example, like, and Jim, you mentioned this in your outline notes. Why do we bring back Pirate Pete and specifically set him up to be Tilly's enemy, arch enemy in the show? And then offload the conflict with Pete to Book and have Tilly, like, now Tilly leading the team on a suicide mission to, okay, like, they, all right, I can go along with that, but then, like, there's no reason for Pirate Pete to be in the show.
No, Pete should have tried to intercept them en route, that would have made some sense.
Exactly.
Again, that part of the crew, they did their thing. They managed to get out of the actual the room itself. They managed to solve it out, but they kind of seem to be floundering around until they get a message from Burnham. Burnham says, "Oh, go and do it. Oh, thanks, Burnham. You've saved us. We didn't know what the hell we were doing. I've just been the captain for the last so many weeks, but I can't do anything without your acknowledgement." It's just so annoying. Give them some agency. Give them some bloody intelligence. They're Starfleet officers. They're supposed to know stuff, and they don't do anything.
They should. This is their ship.
Yeah.
Tilly should be like,
Tilly, especially.
I know exactly what to do. Yeah. I know how this ship. This is a recurring Star Trek theme, right? This goes all the way back to, you got to know how things work on a starship. This goes back to Wrath of Khan.
This goes back to the motion picture when Colt couldn't figure out how the fucking Tobolith worked.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. This goes all the way back to motion picture. And she should be like, okay, I know how to get around. She's Tilly. She knows this ship better, as well as anybody, and it's 1,000 years old. Like, it should be like, Osiris should be like, oh, I can't figure out how to get these damn things to work. The ship is so outdated. Until he's like, I got you, right? But anyway, yeah. And okay, so there's so many things for us to talk about. Well, after the show is over, I watched a very short kind of behind the scenes commentary on the show by the showrunner and several of the cast members. And they talked about how the theme of the season was connection, which ties into the I hear a heavy sigh from
I just thought it was a nice drop it's not a good sign.
It ties into Roddenberry's quote at the end of the episode. But and I can see it. Like, I see all these characters struggling with their connection, right? Like, I see Adira, who embodies multiple people that can't communicate with each other. I see and the burn itself as a metaphor for the breaking down of communication. And I see what they're getting at. Like, I understand it. And if they had told me that at the beginning of the season, I probably would have been doing a literary deep dive on the theme of connection every episode as we were watching them. But I feel like it didn't. I got so disappointed at the poorly explained and executed subplots throughout the season, and at Burnham being both right all the time and hypocritical in so many of her critiques and actions, that I wanted less Burnham in my Michael Burnham show, and that made me sad. Abe, what about you? Your turn.
Yeah, I think you're right. This is the problem, right? I like these characters, okay?
Yeah.
There's almost the crew, the bridge crew that we've actually been given some background to. I like the characters, right? Like Stamets, I like Culber, I like Tilly, I like Jet Reno a lot. I think she's great. Yeah. I would have liked to see a show where they actually get to do something every episode, right?
Yeah.
Burnham is definitely my least favorite character, okay, out of all of this. And I think the idea that, again, like, as we said before, she's always proven right no matter what she does. Oh, I've done this. Okay, yes, fine. It all works out at the end of the day. And my biggest worry is now, do we have a season 4 where we have no Saru? Do we have a season 4 where Saru is now missing from the crew majority of the time? And Saru is technically, apart from obviously Gray and Adira's kind of trill heritage,
yeah,
he's the only alien character. Apart, actually says something. I mean, Linus is the gag character. Everyone else on the crew member is the Saru. Saru was the Spock. Saru was the EMH. Yeah. Saru was the Data. That's now gone. Now we've just got.
I'm still, your comment about Linus made me remember our rewrite of the ending where Linus transports from room to room shooting.
Yeah. And where was he? Yeah, exactly.
And I'm just going to say, nothing in the episode negates Linus doing that.
That is true.
Like, if you want to do fan fiction, they never told us the number of regulators on that ship. So Linus could have been handling it in the background, and no one knew.
We're going to have to talk about Burnham's spacing of the entire regular
This is the thing. I'm trying to keep my thoughts structured into the episode. That I'm escalating to a rampage for, and I'm just trying to calm it down.
Sun's getting low, big fella.
she gets to first off, they had this whole fight in the data center, which is an obvious plot point they're just creating because we need a plot point. Like this room we've never, which is apparently so important you can fly the entire ship from it. We've never heard of or seen before. It's got this weird like computer wall thing that Osira like pushes her into, and then she comes back out. Like, what's up with all that? And then they resolve the entire plot with an offstage resolution that would do fucking Oedipus proud, right? Like, it's like a Greek tragedy where she just stands in front of a computer and says, okay, take over the ship, beam all the bad guys off, reboot the computer system, and that's it. Like, everybody's gone. The plot's over.
Yeah. She might have just said, computer, solve my problems.
Yeah. Okay, computer, solve my problem. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Ah, so frustrating. Who in the fuck does that?
But it's like I said before, it's just, that room. Okay, so obviously, next generation technical manual, we've got the computer cores on there. We know how big they're supposed to be. We know where they are on the ship itself. The lift literally just delivers them straight to the computer core, so you can just pop straight through. It looks tiny compared to what the computer core size is on the Galaxy D. But yeah, like I say, everything is apparently automated. What does everyone else do? It's like you might just talk, if you could talk to the computer to say, okay, right, let's do this, do that. Oh, by the way, target everyone on the ship to tell it and beam them away. Oh, apart from the nice friendly scientist man, he's okay.
Yeah,
don't do him because he showed some nice stuff to us in the end. He's okay. It's like there's no mention of that. There's no reason for it to be done. If they acknowledged him and said, take this communicator to talk to us, therefore, yeah, whatever. And it's like, well, he didn't beam him off because he had a communicator on him. There's nothing.
If you're gonna space every invader, and I'm pretty sure she just beamed him into space. Yeah. Why is the scientist guy not floating in space?
They're in the middle of nowhere when they do it. They've literally come out of warp. She does it. Where do they go? There's nowhere for them to go. And it's just like, you've killed all of them. Gone. And then, obviously, later on, we see even more destruction coming up and all. But, yeah, it's just crazy.
I feel like we could keep going on, but I should give Jim a chance.
Well, I sort of feel like this episode is going to be difficult to talk about. Okay, this episode is 61 minutes long.
Yeah.
It's the longest episode of this entire season.
Right.
It is the culmination of the last 12 weeks of buildup.
Yep.
It is the third part of a loosely bookended trilogy of the final yep. three episodes.
Yep.
It's the culmination of the mystery plot that's like, there's so many things to talk about. The thing you brought up was the Gene Roddenberry quote. And I kind of want to unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, good.
The theme of connection.
Yes.
And how I can see that that's what they wanted it to be, but I don't think it necessarily accomplishes that. I think those too many people and those too many subplots and not enough is organized.
Okay.
So you have a person whose superpower, and that's what it is at this point in time. Book has a superpower. Right. It's empathy.
Yes.
What's the best way to get people to communicate? Because the Gene Roddenberry quote, which is attributed to the humanist interview he did in 1991 for the Humanist magazine, but actually isn't there. So I don't know where it comes from. It's often cited as that piece, but it's 26 pages long, and I did a file search trying to find the quote. I couldn't find it there. So I have to do some digging to find out where it comes from.
Interesting.
Now I have my own little mystery.
Yeah, so quoted, misattributed.
So it's often misattributed, but it's about communicating with one or two people, and that being what makes it fortunate.
Yeah,
and I know they input the quote at the very end in post production. Like this entire series of Star Trek, the post production was done in COVID quarantine.
Yeah,
so everything was filmed, and then they'll recreating all this stuff, you know, and it's. For being a COVID quarantine, you can't actually be in the room with people. It's a pretty impressive job.
Yeah, yeah.
I
noticed that when they on Twitter, when a thread noted that Tilly's uniform was filmed with the command red color accent, but at the last minute, the show decided to recolor it blue so that they didn't lock her in as being first officer next season.
For me, is nonsense, yeah. Right? Like, your first officer isn't necessarily always going to be red, but Tilly's whole storyline is entering the Command School Academy program, like the officer's training program, like her whole thing of command. Like, she's interested in the science, but she wants to lead people. Like, that's her whole, she wants to be Jim Kong.
They stole the payoff to her plot.
Yeah. And the blue didn't even look all that nice on all. Like the maroon does. Like the maroon as a contrast to bland gray, it stands out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you have this idea of connection. You have a man whose superpower is empathy, which is connection, but he doesn't actually communicate with anything.
Just the monster in the first episode.
Yeah, he talks to the monster, and then we're supposed to, like, I'm supposed to intuit that when he's standing in Stamets' space, he's talking to a tardigrade that I never see off screen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's just frustrating how they get to these ideas. Let's take the Adira plot thread.
Okay.
We have Adira, we have Gray. And I love the setup for like seasons four. Like, we're going to make sure everyone sees you.
Yeah.
Like, Hugh Coble saying that line, like that was emotional for me.
Yes.
In a way, it's very difficult or very personal to describe. And
it was hardly subtle, though. I just will say that. It was hardly subtle. But I agree. but carry on.
But sometimes Star Trek doesn't need to be subtle.
No, it doesn't.
Sometimes
need
it needs to be white and black.
As you
just have to shoot for it.
The performance has totally sold that scene. Like the Hugh and Adira and Gray and the those performers creating that moment, and they sold it to me. I totally got it, Jim.
Just to one thing before we carry on, Culber's reaction to Gray appearing, kind of knocked me a bit for exactly the same reason. Last episode where we were saying where basically. Oh, Stamets says you're my family now, and you go, well, where'd that come from? Same as this. It's like there was no back history. We don't really know if Adira's been telling Culber about Gray all this time because we've never seen it. So it's just like, oh, this person's appeared. Okay, well that makes sense now. But it's like, your family. It's like, well, this is supposed to be the payoff of the plot. This is not supposed to be like, oh, ignore the middle part, then. Same problem.
You're totally right. Jim, go on.
And like talking about macro, like to Aid's point, Kobol is only seen in one scene with Adira having a conversation about the Trill symbiote when we were first introduced to them. Kobol enters rooms that she's asleep in and then she sort of like shrugs them off and then walks away. Like there was some interaction. But we never actually see Culber and Adira have a conversation.
Yeah.
We see it all filtered through Stamets because it's Stamets' plot point. I get that Stamets is the main driver to this, but that was our problem with that as in the last episode.
That's right.
Because it's an unfair power dynamic.
Yeah.
Again, if this had been a slightly more open character episodes, if we had more characters we could actually acknowledge, this could have been the entire season thread and the payoff would have worked. But because we haven't got time to worry about the Stamets stuff going on, we'll just jump. It's like but you wasted time with other stuff you didn't need to do.
But you wasted time with the Detmar plot.
Yes, because that was largely pointless.
You take out the Detmar plot and you give that to Stamets, and Stamets realizing that he has a hole in his life and he wanted something more and he's ungrounded because he's in the far future and he doesn't know exactly what that is. And then he meets this Adira who reminds him of him.
Okay, like, so I'm going to counter propose that instead we keep Detmar, give them more time to unpack that plot and take it away from Burnham.
I think that's sacrosanct on this show.
Sometimes could be easily accomplished because again, it's obviously all the episodes are built around her and whatever. But I say every week, if this was Next Generation, this would have been a through thread, and the payoff would have been, oh my god, I can now see Gray, I can understand what you've been talking about for X amount of episodes.
Yes,
but it's not there.
Yeah.
The line that he really does have pretty eyes. Adela gives that to Stamets, and now we can intuit that Stamets goes home and tells his husband about it because that's what couples do, and we have conversations, and we're not privy to all of it, but because we actually don't see the two of them interacting, it sort of rings hollow. Now Wilson Cruz sells it to me because he's so charismatic and he's so empathetic, like honestly the superpower should have been his. Like if you're gonna look at the cast and be like, okay, we need someone to have empathy powers, let's make it the doctor who is just a bleeding halt.
Now since we brought up Adira, we should have talked about this at the beginning of the episode before we got into the actual show. But there's been a big controversy this week, stemming from one of our favorite website sources, and that's Memory Alpha. We all use Memory Alpha a lot.
Yep.
I've used it both in this show and also to prep my own Star Trek role-playing games. Every time I want to make a character for Star Trek, I mean, Memory Alpha is my go-to, But there's been a huge controversy around Adira's page on Memory Alpha when the moderators and admins of Memory Alpha refused to acknowledge that Adira is non-binary. And the argument, and I'm not taking this side, I'm merely presenting it, is that because no one on the show has explicitly stated that Adira is non-binary,
except for Adira herself. It's word for word.
Yes.
Apart from that instance, that's weird.
And moreover, when I checked this out myself, I went to the Memory Alpha page for Adira, and I checked out the talk section, where the various commentators and the moderators and the admins present, you know, like so someone will log in and say, hey, like Adira uses they pronouns. Maybe we should acknowledge that they're non-binary. And the admins and the moderators are so rude and aggressive, and they obviously have huge grudges and aggression towards like CBS and quote unquote culture warriors and all kinds of stuff. And so they shout down these very courteous, very well-meaning people who log in to say, hey, Adira uses they pronouns. Like let's acknowledge that on the page. And the end result at the moment, last time I checked, is that Memory Alpha had removed all reference to gender on the entire platform in order to avoid addressing Adira's gender identity. Jim?
Fucking seriously. I had not hold this last bit.
That is puzzling. Yes, that is very, very puzzling. Yes.
I had not hold this last bit at all. So last night I started hearing, you know, a lot of people I follow, you know, they identify as non-binary.
Yeah.
And, you know, I interact with them. They're great Trekkies. A lot of them are doing great work in terms of like getting Trek swag to, you know, from people who don't want it anymore and giving it to people who do want it, like for free. And like all this sort of like great sort of community building.
Yeah.
And when that person posts, you know, I don't feel welcome in my community. I'm like, what the fuck? Yeah. So I immediately, you know, started tracking down what it was, and I heard about the Memory Alpha thing. And I'm like, this is repugnant. Like the level of vitriol and the discourse and sort of the knee-jerk reaction to this, and now the overreaction to remove all gender identity, like just so that we're still excluding. Like this is a power dynamic that's being played where people in charge want to continue marginalizing folks. And to what end? Like this is so antithetical to Star Trek and the ethos and edict that I am disgusted. Like, I won't even go to the site anymore. Like, I block them on my Twitter feed, and I won't go to Memory Alpha. Like, I can go grab my Star Trek encyclopedia off the bookcase and look at it, look at that if I need to.
Well, people like me aren't quite as skilled at all of this as you, so I still have to use it, but I'm going to cry when I do.
Yeah. I find it weird, right? Okay, so I can't comment on the Memory Alpha stuff because I've not read it, right? Okay, so yeah, I don't know exactly. But When the Adira was first introduced and they were calling them she all the while, I said,
yes.
Why did they do that?
Why?
I couldn't understand why they did not do that from day one, because the idea, and like they said, they said they were supposed to be making a point that they explained that they felt different. Da, da, da. And you can kind of understand, because as for a TV show point of view, they were trying to get this character to be identifiable. So they could say, okay, I reflect that. But as I said before, the idea that in the 32nd century that is an issue, that bugged me straight away anyway.
Yeah.
But them not mentioning they feel that way in the show, we all know is bullshit, because we know that the Adira literally says it to Stamets, okay?
Yeah. Yes.
Other characters may not. Because like, then, I don't know, because I can't think of people referencing Adira at all directly in my memory. Of like, but they don't interact with many characters. So the idea that Stamets is the only one acknowledging the fact is possibly because Adira only has episodes with Stamets. That's it. You know, it's just like, what can you do? Yeah.
As soon as Adira says that, and it becomes, and I think that the reason why they first called Adira she, we talked about this in our season commentary, is so that they could set up the teachable moment, right? Like they want people to address her as she. So that Adira can push back on that and say, no, that's not me. And we can have that conversation. Because if they were addressed by they from the first episode, we would have lost that moment. And so, okay. But then the plot falls prey to what we've been talking about all season. The fact that not enough time is spent on these subplots to unpack them and show what's going on. And so as soon as Adira says that and Stamets says, oh, okay, it then vanishes. Like the plot ceases to exist as much as our helmsman, I can't believe I forgot her name again.
Detmer.
Much as Detmer's damage to her head just suddenly disappears and that plot goes ceases to be relevant or to ever exist. Now Adira, so no one ever refers to Adira as they, because there's no scene where Adira, not to create a scene where they refer to Adira as they, that's not the point, but just to have any scene at all with Adira in which their pronoun might show up and be used, that Adira doesn't get any screen time hardly.
Yeah. Most of the time that any other character refers to him is with their name.
Yeah, by name.
So it's like, it's almost like you're almost sidestepping the issue by just using Adira as the name. It's like, so I mean, even Gray, there's no, which you would assume would be the one person to use it.
Yeah,
just goes Adira, and it's like, okay.
Yeah. Well, so to be fair, Gray is the way they've written Gray is they've put him into a box where the only person he can talk to is Adira.
Yeah. Yes, true.
And when I talk to someone, if I'm talking to Jason one-on-one, right, I'm not going to refer to him as he or any pronoun because it's a direct line of conversation.
True.
Yeah. All right.
You're right.
We have a very small audience on this show, but I call upon Memory Alpha, the administrators of that site, to take a good self-reflective look at their moderators and the tone that's used. And to acknowledge that they are in the wrong and to take some steps to address this, because we all want to use that site. We want to embrace Memory Alpha as a part of the Star Trek community. And we can't do that in the current situation.
And Memory Alpha has power. Like, it's not just a Wikipedia. When Simon Pegg sat down to write Star Trek Beyond, yes, he consulted... called up every time he had a technical question. He called up the moderators of Memory Alpha.
There you go.
That's a one-to-one ratio.
It's so easy to cross-reference stuff on that with stuff you see in the novel, in the novels, and in the actual encyclopedias to make sure you're kind of on the right track. It's a shame.
And when you were writing the game stats for the Star Trek game, you consulted Memory Alpha.
Oh, totally. Because I used to know background and history stuff that was hinted upon in stuff like this, and just to make sure that I wasn't misremembering stuff. Yeah.
All right. Moving on.
Okay.
Let's talk about that goddamn turbo lift scene.
Okay.
Because I'm watching the show and they pry open the turbo lift, and it's like, okay, where the hell are they? They can't be on Discovery. That place is huge. Like, it's this vast, enormous, cavernous space. And I'm like, wait a minute. Are they on, like, this? It looked like they were on Starfleet headquarters or something. It was so... Now, it's... Like, that can't be the inside of Discovery. And yet the show is trying to tell me that it is. And I'm like, they totally... I lost all believability when that happened. Abe, you went off on this.
Oh, it's terrible. Utterly terrible. It's just so badly designed to say this is the inside of the Discovery. But then, referring to the technical manual, we know what the turbo lifts look like. They go up and down, and then sometimes they've got left to right shafts so they can travel along, and they take it. That's what a turbo lift does. They don't hover. They don't fly around. There's not a big empty space they go from A to B in. But even the ride, how long it takes to get from A to B, it's like, how big is Discovery now? Is it now Galaxy's class size? It's just so stupid.
You know what bugged me? Like, okay, there's all these other turbo lifts going up and down.
Yeah.
Who is that?
Who's like, in that? Yeah.
The bridge is sealed. The Enterprise, the bridge crew of Discovery is off in one of the nacelles. Who's going up and down all those turbo things? Like, nobody.
Again, this seems to be the idea that this was like, I got a great idea for a scene. It's like, what is it? Well, we need a turbo lift. Okay. Well, obviously, yeah. It's just like, it's so wrong.
This was a J.J. Abrams imitation moment gone terribly horrible.
Oh, totally. It's like fighting Khan on the back of the car.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Um, this would have been great if this was the show, if this was the show season one.
Okay.
Like if they had told us in like episode one that the way Discovery is constructed is all the rooms that you see is on the against the hull and it's a hollow ship.
Which makes
the only way this works.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like if it was like Babylon 5, like Babylon 5 is a superstructure and everything is built around the outside and that's how they simulate gravity is they rotate the hull.
Because it rotates. Like there's a reason for the ship to be
hollow. Yeah. Like if that's what the show was telling us from day one, I'd be fine with it. Even if they got a brand new starship, they got a brand new 32nd century starship and they're like, hey, this is how it works. And I would have been okay to accept it. But they're still using the same sets. They're still using the same visual cues. And we know how the Enterprise is built. The Enterprise is a contemporary ship of Discovery. We know how that ship's built. We have the schematics. We know how, like, I don't know how I don't know how Jeffrey's tubes walk alongside this giant chasm of space.
Yeah.
Do we place the blame for this on the COVID situation? The fact that all of the post-production, all of that sequence, like the writers wrote, okay, there's this rollicking roller coaster ride on the turbo lift. And then the special effects guys took it and created this cavernous space, like something out of Monsters, Inc. And
oh my God, it is Monsters, Inc. It's
true, with the doors. And then it was too late to change it.
I'm going to say no, and here's why.
Okay.
So among all the visual noise that I was sort of tuning out, they give you like these little checkpoints, like in a video game, they give you the little checkpoints.
Yeah.
And they're like these weird circular spheres and the Tobolith travels through it. Yeah. And when the Tobolith hits it, they do the little Tobolith sound effect.
Okay.
So I think this was planned. Like this wasn't like accidental, like, okay, we have a Tobolith fight scene. I think this was intended. Because of that attention to detail to like, how do we explain where it goes? Womp, womp, womp. Because originally that is just the Tobolith traveling between decks.
Right.
And that is the sound of the deck thing. But when they abstract it into this giant void, they added this new technique that the only reason it exists is so that you get the classic sound effect.
Maybe. One of our audience members, Don, he also commented on the weird ring, speed boost rings.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was terrible. It was easily the worst thing in it. It was laughably bad. That was the problem. It was like, because again, I had to stop exactly and go, are they on Cyrus ship now? What's going on? It's like, this is Discovery's Turbolift network. It's like, no, it's not. This is stupid.
I will say the only time I enjoyed this extended action scene, which again, I don't know why it's Buck versus Pirate Pete.
Yes. Should be telling.
Was once he throws him out and you actually see the body like smash into something before it like rappels. Like that was the Phantom Menace, you know, doubling down of no, this character's really dead.
Yeah.
And he shouts out, she is a queen. I feel that was the setup payoff that has been owned throughout the whole season just because of his insistent callbacks to Grudge as a queen, and when it actually happened and it paid off and it was a one-liner in an action scene, I'm like, okay, I can't forgive you for this egregious Tobolith nonsense.
Yeah.
But this moment, I liked it.
Yeah, it's a running gag that they actually paid off, unlike Linus, right?
The crazy thing about it is as well is that the idea that Book kicks him off, I actually missed it. I didn't see that bit. My brain shut off, I think, and I didn't actually see it. Right? But it just went into lockdown, and eventually it's like, whoa, okay, where are we now? We've got exactly the same comeuppance as like, I remember that bit in Star Trek Picard when 7 and 9 kicks the person. Oh yeah, let's do that again. Oh, remember that bit in Star Trek Original Series where Kirk does that to the Klingon. Oh yeah, let's do that again. It's like, this, are you really doing this again? Are you really doing callbacks to both of those and expecting someone to go, wait a minute, I know this bit before.
But in the comments about like the thing that made you like laughably bad and the worst bit of the entire episode, I have to confess there was another thing that also really stuck out to me. And that was Burnham's inexplicable need to destroy the warp core, to eject the warp core.
Yeah.
Because they did not need to do that. They used the spore drive to teleport from outside of the Emerald Chain starship to go back to the nebula. The only reason to eject the warp core is to blow up the Emerald Chain ship. which they did not need to do. And now that we've established that one warp core can blow up that entire ship, well, then why don't we have warp core torpedoes starting next season? I mean, it's like the hyperspace tactic used in Last Jedi, right? It's like, well, now we've asked him, we have this super weapon, and there's nothing to stop you from doing it literally every time, which now brings me back to the time travel problem, and it all goes full circle. Time's a flat circle.
Yeah.
And it brings me back to the quote. And it brings, so the whole point of the quote is talking to people who are alien than you. And Star Trek Discovery has had these conversations. We've had these disconnects, these characters that are ungrounded by their context and temporal space. We had one character literally being torn apart by whole connection to whole previous context.
Right.
The whole point of that quote is, I'm an alien, you're an alien. We may not agree on things, but we can continue talking. And if we continue talking, we can develop understanding and rapport.
That's right.
So Osira, the only thing I was really concerned about with the last episode was Osira as this, you know, bad guy, but not bad guy, to quote Wreck-It Ralph, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm a villain, but I have a reason I'm doing this.
Yeah.
There's a goal in place. Like, you know, even the Emperor of Star Wars is like, I just want there to be order. Like, the universe is in chaos, and I have this need to have order.
Osira is made up to look like the Wicked Witch of the West.
That's true. Yeah.
She looks like the Wicked Witch of the West. And yet, last episode, she revealed this complexity to her, which is, yes.
And that gets immediately photon torpedoed because all of a sudden, like, we don't even explore the ramifications of asking an Orion woman to give up her agency to be prosecuted.
I'm gonna get you and your little cat too.
Yeah, like in the universe, Orion animal women were slaves.
Yeah.
We don't actually explore that space in terms of, like, why she can't do it. Like, I can't give up my freedom because I'm not a slave.
Right.
Like, we don't even explore that. So instead, she just becomes a cartoon villain. She's torturing people. She's ham-fistedly a bad guy. So we have to blow up her ship. But that flies in the face of the quote, which is bringing people together and having a conversation.
Again, if this was a standard Trek series, okay. Osira would have been introduced in episode one. We would have, by the time we'd have episode 13, maybe even a couple of seasons in, we would have a similar situation where we have with Golda Cat, and we've actually got, like, oh, this character's got a background. He does this because of that. He does this because of that. But the idea that Orion women are slaves and she practices slavery, it's like, where's that story? Where is that kind of like, I can see what I'm doing, it's bad, but it's the only way for us to survive? Or where's this, oh, well, okay, whatever. But the idea that is just like, well, she does it. Oh, she's doing what she's doing, and oh, I'm going to try and reform the universe by joining up with the Federation. Oh, they've not done anything. Right, hissy fit time. I'm going to start just smashing stuff up. It's just like, what's the point? It just makes complete mockery of her as a villain because she's got no background to her. There's nothing to her to actually make her interesting apart from literally she just goes into King Kong mode and just starts smashing stuff up.
And the point to Golda Khan is he's still Hitler.
Oh, he's still, like, he's doing
just up. Hitler. Yeah. He's just deluded to think that he's a hero of his narrative, right? The show, Deep Space Nine takes the time to deconstruct and show how ultimately pathetic this character is, to the point where he's co-opting magic religions that he doesn't even believe, you know, belong to.
Yeah.
Like, Osira deserved better than what she got in this episode, which is the Lorca treatment.
Yeah, even Garrick had it's Garrick, isn't it? You knew he did bad stuff over the course of his thing, but at least he had a bit of a background to it. Yeah, at least he had a bit of a motivation again because of his environment and the planet was on. You know, that's what he did to survive, and you know, he got ostracized onto. But this is just like, oh, I'm bad because I'm bad. I've got this relationship with a human, but it's not really quite explored if they are actually together, because we mentioned he's got a family, but we don't actually know if it's her family as well. I mean, it's just like you're trying to do something with them, but then you just throw it up in the air and just say, nah, she's a bad guy. She's just going to smash stuff up.
And the thing that the galling thing is, there's this Ayn Rand element to this whole plot point, which if you've ever read The Fountainhead or any of those awful books, don't just save yourself. But all the characters, they want this, like all the main characters in those books, they want the same thing. They just want it in slightly different variations. Yeah. Like if your theme is togetherness and communication and finding common goal, and that's what the makes the Federation different from the Emerald Chain, don't give the Emerald Chain the same plot. Don't give Osira the plot of, oh, I want to bring everyone together. Here's this whole plan about how we can unify all two factions. Make it so that she's like, no, I want to compartmentalize everything. Like having different worlds as their own independent nation states is better for the capitalistic goal. Don't have it whole, spend a whole hour, give me something that's interesting and character development if you're just going to have a blowing up people and torturing people and like choking a guy in a wheelchair.
I mean, the Vader deal is like, if you did like, okay, right, you're the Federation, we're both dying, you're dying, we're dying, we can't do anything. If we could rule the galaxy as father and son, you know, if at least that would be something different, you know, the idea that it's like the Federation are dying, if you change the way and do things we do, then obviously you can survive. And Vance could at least say, well, no, that's not the way we do things. At least that'd be something. But the idea is she's willing to give all this stuff up and they say, well, not really. All right, screw you then, I'm off. You know, it just seems weird.
All right, so moving on to, we're running out of time, but there's a few things I still want to touch on. I want to talk about Saru. Saru had his time as captain. There's in that behind the scenes featurette I mentioned, there's a few minutes with Doug Jones talking about the character. Everyone is very careful about not saying if he's going to be on the crew or not. But Jones speculates on what the future of Saru might be. And one of the things he said, his final suggestion is Ambassador Saru. And I see that. I can see Ambassador Saru, Federation Ambassador. He obviously is very good at that. Like they established that when he was talking with the Vulcan president. He's good at being an ambassador. He's good at building connections. He's terrible at making the wrong call in a stressful situation. And what's sad, they never gave him a chance to really get better at that. Instead, they shuffled him off to make room for Burnham. Jim, in our Twitter conversations, you described him as being a movie captain. What do you mean?
All right. So we watched all the films in the season before this. We watched every one of the films and those good and bad with those films. One of the weakest things is Star Trek III. Because Star Trek III gives you three people of authority who are either ranked slightly below Admiral Kolk or above Admiral Kolk in the chain of command.
Yeah.
So you have the captain of the Grissom, who is too cautious. You have the captain of the Excelsior, who's too aggressive.
Right.
And then you have the Admiral, who was like, no, Jim, you can't do this. Like, he's literally there to be the living embodiment of the Prime Directive, right? He's there just to be the thing that you fly in the face of.
Yeah.
So all these people are weak characters, the weak strawmen for Kolk to blow past.
Yeah.
And Saru, constantly through the season, is being shown as an ineffectual captain because everyone, whether it's Bonham, who's being proven right by the plot, or whether it's Vance pulling him aside going, no, that's the wrong call to make.
Yeah.
Everyone in the show is telling Saru, you are wrong. And we never get Saru's moment of being right. Like, even when he's dealing with Sukal, Kobol has that line. Like, and it's the only time I want Wilson Cruz to shut the fuck up and get off the screen. Because right. Saru is like almost there to get him to push past the feel. And then like in a really bad role-playing game, like the one guy who's off to the side rolls a 20 and is like, yes, you can walk past your feel. And it's just repeating everything that Saru's been saying, but he delivers it with such a pomp and such emotional haunt that that's the thing that motivates him. And then Saru is left in role-playing terms, like he has like one line after that and it's just ineffectual, like, yeah, we're with you together. Like it's that, we'll do this together thing.
It was funny to hear Saru say together one more time, which is clearly his like character. He's got that aspect written on his character sheet, right? Like we'll do this together, and he's got to tag it every once in a while to get fate points.
And the mind blowing thing is like season two. The reason we have this field data, the whole reason that you know, that's a plot point, is in season two, Saru is so empathetic that his mind reached out and touched this ancient intelligence that was dying. And the ancient intelligence that was dying related to Saru because it was also an outcast and it was also alone. So you have these people who have like these empathic backgrounds as like character traits that just get lost in the shuffle of all these sort of plot elements. Captain, like the show doesn't have time to breathe.
Aid, Captain Saru.
Again, if he's not in the next season, he's the other character. He's the character. He's the data character. He's the year of age character. Yeah. He's the character that makes it interesting. He's got a different background from most people. I really like Saru. I think he's a cool character. I preferred Saru when he was science officer Saru because, like you said before, Captain Saru seems to just be double guessed every single time he does something. Oh no, that's wrong. You go and do something off over there and make yourself do some busy work while Burnham solves all the problems. That just annoys me. just shrugging. As you said just now, you said about the spore data. Okay, so the sphere data. Sorry, the sphere data was brought under control because Saru touched it with his mind, and there was some kind of thing, right? So why the hell have we got the spore data shows up, gets put into robots, does nothing apart from charging into combat, gets blown up. There's no solution. There's no. Oh my God, you're the vast knowledge thing of you can solve this. No, run into things, right? So why are we in a situation where, number one, theoretically, even in the episode where the sphere data suggested Saru about movie night, there's a connection between those two characters because it suggested to him. It suggested to Burnham, suggested to Saru. So the idea that the sphere data didn't go to Kaminar with Saru in one of those droids, because apparently we don't need it anymore, and it's, you know, and originally it was, oh, we can only upload it to a starship size memory, but now we can pop it in a couple of droids, so we can put it in your hand luggage. It's like, take it to Kaminar. So that would have been something as well. The idea he kind of becomes the guardian of the sphere data would obviously give him another kind of, you know, kind of an upgrade, kind of like Cisco, kind of that thing, kind of like, okay, you've done your thing, but you've not captured anymore, but you're now, you know, in charge of the sphere data. But the Sakaal thing and all, that still narks me so much, that the idea that magic did it caused the dilithium problem, and everyone immediately just goes, well, that's okay. You're only responsible for thousands of people's deaths, but you can't. It's like, just give me something. Give me some explanation. Give me some kind of, like, we had to talk these people around. It was explained. The idea that the Vulcans wouldn't be annoyed because they were blamed for the burn, and then it turns out there was something else. It's just these lines of dialogue that should be there, and they just brush it aside, and it's like, oh, happy ending for everybody, and it's just like, that's not right.
I know we're trying to wrap it up, but the Sakaal thing just galls me on one aspect. So we see what happened with the bone, and it's what we thought it was, which was mom dying.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sakaal at one point had to go through Varahai. He had to go through the same ganglia thing that Saru went through. So why isn't there a second bone? Like, why isn't there, like, 50 years later, we had a second, like, smaller event when he thought he was going to die?
Yeah.
Like, because biologically, he was getting sick. Because we saw Saru do this last season. He got sick. He couldn't stand. He couldn't think straight. He was a weak on the knees. And they reference it in season 3 with the Mirror Universe.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's not like, so they even give people the reminder halfway through the season to say, oh, this is what happens. Yeah.
And it goes nowhere, does nothing.
I love your observation, Aid, that Saru was a better science officer and even first officer than he was captain, because he was allowed to be successful. He was allowed to be right in those jobs. Whereas as captain, his job is to be the foil for Burnham and the movie captain. A role, as you put it, Jim, and it's so unfortunate because Saru won our hearts from the beginning of the character in season one. Like, he was always so interesting, and Doug Jones brings this wonderful trailing clouds of glory. You know, I'm quoting Wagner. You know, he brings this huge reputation to the character, and we all love how he's physically made that character embody a new, an alien culture, and the way he walks and the way he talks and his look. And but when we saw Doug Jones get to play himself without makeup for two episodes, it was a swan song. We could all see it. It's like Giorgio leaving the show.
Now Doug Jones has shaved his head. He is doing filming for season four. Okay. But again, it's what is that going to take?
Yeah.
Like, what form does that take? And I think Ambassador Saru probably has more credence with, we don't want to undermine Captain Bonham.
For sure. Yeah. All right. Well, so there's only one thing that we have left to talk about. There's a million things we could talk about, but the thing that we cannot go without talking about, which, as we know, is the most important thing in all Star Trek canon, is the uniforms. Jim, you want to start off with the uniform?
They're ugly. I hate them. they look... So there's this weird trend in sort of new Trek, and I don't mean it in derogatory, but just like post 2009 Star Trek,
yeah,
when they make up these new uniforms that are homaging something, and they want to simplify everything. They want to make it like a solid color, and then there's an accent color.
Yeah.
The problem is that's a bellhop uniform. Yeah. Like Star Trek Into Darkness has Zachary Quinto and Chris Pine walking the Starfleet headquarters with like little caps underneath their helmets. They look like bellhops. And the new Discovery uniforms look just as bland and uninteresting as you can possibly get.
Totally, yeah. I agree. They look like those ones. They look like the ones from the movies, the Kelvinverse movies, that I don't like the grey at all. They also remind me of Cycle uniforms from Babylon 5, with the collars and stuff. It's just like, no, they're horrible. They're absolutely, absolutely horrible. And again, why did they get these when they upgraded the ship? Because they knew this is going to be the payoff part at the end of the season. Oh, we've got to have them having the uniform. It's like, yeah, but you're saying it just doesn't make any sense.
I think the show recognized that they needed new uniforms on the basis of the uniform that they had really only was a benefit to Doug Jones and to Sonequa Martin-Green. Because they're very lithe people, they're very slender, and all the lines were directed downward. So, you know, it looked good on them, but everyone else on the show looked a little kind of out of place. So I think the show recognized that they needed something. I do like the fact that it's not overly designed. Like, we don't have thousands of little Star Trek arrowheads on the uniforms. But I'm just like, why is gray the standard straight? You know, like, they look like Space 2000, you know, 2099 costumes.
Yeah. The other thing is the jumpsuits look very, very similar to Enterprise jumpsuits and the original ones. And now we've got gray uniforms. If they do that poster with all the characters in, they're going to stand out as being a different TV series from Enterprise. You know, it's like, oh, the blue people are the same. It's like, no, they're the gray people. They're the shunned ones. They're the ones that we don't like anymore. We don't like the gray uniforms. I mean, they're almost to motion picture badness. I hate the motion picture uniforms. These really rank up there with it.
So I have to start off by saying that I never liked Discovery's original uniforms. I always thought they were bad, too busy, just bizarre. I never liked them. They just looked weird to me. I think that, Jim, your point about them only looking good on people who are slender is absolutely true. And the new ones obviously are not as form-fitting. They struck me as a very cosplayable uniform, which I don't think is an accident. I think they're designed to be something that somebody with a very modest ability to create clothing, to create costumes in their home, could make.
Someone with a boiler suit and some reflective tape is what you're saying.
Yeah, and I know you laugh at it, but I think that might be part of the reason behind them. I think they're intentionally designed. Marvel does this, has been doing this for years with the when they and DC as well, when they redesign female superhero uniforms from, you know, Batgirl and Ms. Marvel to something that's more cosplayable by people that people aren't going to be able to make and in a way that they can comfortably wear. I do think there's a little bit of homage going on in the uniform. I don't think it's entirely new. That side panel with the color is a mirror of the maroon uniforms with the flap and the buttons. It's not actually a flap. It doesn't have buttons on it, but that line is an artistic homage to the cinematic uniforms of the Wrath of Khan era. It's funny that I think it looks better on people that aren't slender. On Captain Burnham, it looks kind of baggy, and it looks like she's wearing a sack. I'm not wild about it, but I actually like it better than the original Discovery uniform. So I consider it a step up from worse to bad. But anyway,
In defense of the Discovery uniforms, yeah. The original ones at least, it's that midpoint. Like you pitch your show and you're like, this is going to be in between Enterprise and TOS, like
yeah.
close to the
yeah.
TOS. So you're going to get the primary color kind of scheme, but you still have to deal with the fact that they were using NASA jumpsuits as the inspiration for the Enterprise costumes. Correct. So it kind of felt like it was at least an evolution within that chain, because we don't have, you know, 1,000 years of Starfleet uniform history. Like, I don't know, like there's no context for these things. I don't know like what has been added and removed. They just look weird and I just don't like them.
Okay, and I've also got something else that also ties into this as well.
Yes.
The scene where they all line up on the bridge, right? So,
yeah.
Why does Adira get a jumpsuit? It's like, well, hold on, wait a minute. This ain't going on here, right? So you can't give them a communicator, because apparently you need to steal Jet Reno's communicator to travel to transport. Which again, I've got a plan. Your plan is to take medicine to the people. That's not a plan. That's just delivery service. Anyway, but it's like, so all the other characters, we assume the standards okay. It's like, okay, well you do so many years of Starfleet Academy to become a member. Apart from you get to be a member of Starfleet because you're just there. You get to have a uniform and a communicator. It's like it's such a I don't know. I think Adira works better almost as like the kind of like the hanger on scientific advisor, as like in the oh my god, the Peter David novels. They had the Thalonian Empire. They had the guy, the prince guy there, who was kind of like, he was there on the bridge. He knew what was going on in the area, but he wasn't a member of Starfleet. And I think Adira should have been that. Yeah. But now it's just like, you're a member of Starfleet. You're a member of the crew. It's like, well,
Book's not in a uniform.
No, like, Book's not, which is surprising.
Yes. Adira should be in the same class that Book is, like a civilian who hangs out with us.
Yeah. I mean, give him a communicator, because that makes perfect sense. You need one. Why wouldn't you have one? But I just think it's just like, well, that's weird. Because it's even got like a color designation like everybody else's. There's not even a difference from anybody else's to say, well, you're an advisory role, you're whatever. But I thought that was very strange.
Oh, and that character's name that you were thinking of was Saquon. And I just want it known that we have gone how many episodes, and I'm not the one to bring up New Frontier Falls.
Sorry,
so I'm going to call it a win. I'm going to call it a win for me. It was straight.
So for 13 weeks in a row, we have been here with all of you working through Discovery. This is the end of our third season as well. We did the first season of Picard. We did every single Star Trek film. And we have done the latest season of Discovery. It has been a lot of fun. Thank you all for joining us and following along with us. We are talking amongst ourselves about what we will do next. We have plans, but we're going to take a little break for a while and maybe take care of some other national business before we come back. But we will be back. After a little break, Jim, Aid, anything you guys would like to say?
I just want to thank. First, I want to thank my fellow podcasters, Jason and Aid. You guys have been great. I have appreciated this immensely while struggling through, you know, quarantine and staring at a whole bunch of, like, these are the Zoom calls I look forward to.
Yeah.
It's been a lot of fun, and you know, I'm looking forward to whatever season four looks like for us.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it. And thank everyone who takes the time to comment in the retweets we post out. And you just show up for, you know, listening to us. It's appreciated.
Dale and Don and Carrie and the three people that log in every week to watch us, like, you guys are hardcore. We love all of you. Aid?
Yeah, I'm surprised they can hear me rant every week. It's quite I don't want to seem too overly critical of the show because I love Star Trek. I mean, I've written for stuff for Star Trek. I love Star Trek, and I get disappointed when I see stuff that just makes me go, oh my god, I would not do that. I really, really hope that it carries on and we get something good from it. You know, again, like you said, this is a potential reset effectively for Discovery. Let's see what happens from now on. But please, Discovery people, give the other characters some screen time, for Christ's sake. That's all I can say.
All right, everyone. Well, take care of yourselves. Be kind to your loved ones. Reach out and connect, because we're all in this together, right? Live long and prosper, everyone.